Here is the midnight news, and this is Alvar Lidero reading it. Up to 10 o'clock, 175 German...
The King has been to see his Royal Air Force in the field. At our station, His Majesty was aware...
It's December 1939, and the BBC's blockbusting bandwagon show has just come off air for the last time. On the home front, the need is for large helpings of light relief, but the BBC bosses have a problem. The audience thinks that much of what's on the wireless is absolute rubbish. MPs have been complaining about the output in Parliament, and the BBC's own variety department is in turmoil. Worse than that, it's in Bristol.
It was utter chaos. It really was.
Anne Ziegler, singing partner and wife of the late Webster Booth.
Webster was under contract, and within 10 minutes of getting there and getting out of the car, they were grabbing him and saying, for God's sake, come, you're on the radio. We haven't got anybody. We haven't got any singers. We haven't got this and that and the other.
John Watt, the BBC's hapless director of variety, was hunkered down in Bristol, his department having been moved there under the BBC's wartime dispersal master plan. With just 22 performers, one orchestra, and one studio at his disposal, Watt had to fill acres of airtime under less than perfect conditions. Cheerful background listening between news bulletins was what London had ordered, and lots of it. As many as 9 programmes a day, all of them live. Actor Maurice Denham was one of the Bristol 22.
It was exciting altogether. Hectic, but exciting. Very little rehearsal for anything. The amount of work one was doing for £8 a week, paying £1 for our digs, so, was phenomenal, really.
But that first December of the war had brought sad news for bandwagon fans when John Watt was forced to wind up the show. Watt, however, had a secret weapon. A show he believed would transcend the madcap world of Big and Stinker.
We've got a barn of a farm, right in the middle of a swamp. There ain't any charm in our little farm.
It revolved round another Liverpool comic called Tommy Handley. Handley, a one-time toy salesman, had been working on and off for the BBC since the very early days of radio at Savoy Hill.
We're miserable, so miserable down on misery farm.
A sketch of army life in World War I called The Disorderly Room was Tommy Handley's springboard to radio fame in the 1920s. Handley had started out as just another baritone, light songs, singer of, but wanted to be a comedian. And as early as 1928, was doing so well that Sir John Reith, BBC Director General, presented him with a gold cigarette case. Crumbs.
Hello, hello, this is Mr. Winterbottom calling, and Mr. Murgatroyd and I are going to give you a running commentary.
Rowing commentary on the annual boat race between Cambridge and Oxford.
Oxford and Cambridge.
Laurel and Hardy.
Sausage and Mash.
E&OE.
Pan and Swaffer.
And Oxford and Cambridge.
By the time the 1930s came along, Handley's principal claim to fame was as one half of a double act called Murgatroyd and Winterbottom with Ronald Franco. Their trademark was burlesque, send-ups of commentaries on big national events like the boat race and the derby. Dated to modern ears, of course, but before the war, Handley's brand of machine-gunning crosstalk was groundbreaking stuff. And in 1939, it was his ticket to stardom.
Pray silence for that grandiloquent gasbag, that imponderable impresario, the right ramshackle, Tommy Handley.
Hello, folks. Have you seen the new birthday honours? My friend the Colonel got the double X with bar, and I got the LMS third class with the refreshment room. Well, I'm sorry I've had to refuse so many of your applications to stay at my hotel, but at present, accommodation is absolutely cut to the cubicle. My utility beds are a great success. No one can sleep in them, so they get up early and I let the room to somebody else.
ITMAR, It's That Man Again, was Britain's funniest and most celebrated wartime radio show. It was hatched over several rounds of pink gins in the raddled Edwardian splendour of the old Langham Hotel opposite Broadcasting House. The show's title, It's That Man Again, was stolen from a headline about Hitler in the Daily Express, and the programme launched in July 1939 with Handley cast as Master of Ceremonies on a cruise ship. The first series was not a success, but just like Bandwagon, ITMAR survived a wobbly start, and in a way profited from it. A series of outside broadcasts from the radio exhibition at Olympia interrupted the first run, which was probably just as well, because by the time ITMO was back on the air, war had been declared and BBC Variety was in Bristol. Writer Ted Kavanagh moved his family from London and found what he called a chaotic mess. Ted Kavanagh's son, the writer and critic, P.J. Kavanagh.
Everything became very informal. People became very dependent on each other. Of necessity, they were friendly with each other. We lived almost literally on top of each other. We shared boarding houses and digs and, I mean, secretaries, and we were sort of crammed into studios, and I was moved about sometimes. And so there was a general feeling of something I've missed ever since, in a way, because I thought that was life. I thought that was how it was. Everybody being very friendly and mucking in with each other and so forth.
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. With a tear, not a tear, make it gay.
So, in September 1939, ITMO returned with a brand new format. No more sailing in the high seas. Handley was now cast as a make-believe cabinet minister in charge of the Ministry of Aggravation and Mysteries, housed in the office of Twerps. In those dismal days of proliferating red tape and wartime regulations, the format instantly struck a chord with the audience, and other new characters followed. There was Funf, the German spy, alias Jack Train, and a glass tumbler.
Hello?
This is Funf speaking.
You sound as though you've got a touch of the Timoshenkos.
I will see that your stage company does not arrive tonight.
Oh, yes, they will. I'm sitting on one of the baskets now.
There will be no train.
What, not even Jack Train?
There will be no show either. Funf, I spoke.
There was Handley's secretary, Dottie, played by Vera Lennox, and ITMO's first charlady, Lola Tickle, the creation of Morris Denham.
She used to say, "Oh, Mr. Handley, I always do my best for all my gentlemen." Oh, dear. Then I did the Radio Falkenberg, which was a foreign radio station. And I used to finish up with "Vous pouvez cracher," something to do with spitting, but... I got doing a lot of the effects to animal noises. That's quite simple, really. Fundamental.
Writer and historian Barry Took was a great fan of ITMO.
The great thing about ITMO was that it went at a cracking pace. Tommy Handley, who was terribly experienced, was a brilliant comedian. He was swift, he was accurate, he was disciplined, he was quick-witted, and he was inventive. The combination of Francis Worsley, the producer, and Ted Kavanagh, the writer, and Tommy Handley, the comedian, was dynamic. It was what, I suppose, in theatrical terms, you would call crossovers, quick cameos. Doors would open, somebody would come in, do their catchphrase, and go away again.
After you, Claude!
No, after you, Sizzle.
Don't forget the diver, sir. Don't forget the diver.
Oh, no likey. Oh, crikey.
Catchphrases abounded. This is Funf speaking. It's been so cheerful, it keeps me going. Boss, boss, something terrible's happened. Can I do you now, sir? Today you listen and you think, why is that funny? But at the time, you know, the tensions of war, it was a wonderful, wonderful release for half an hour a week.
What's mystifying is how on earth the BBC got through that first winter, given wartime restrictions, shortages, programme censorship, and the worst weather for years.
One hopes the listener hadn't the faintest idea that there was anything remotely wrong.
Roger Worsley, son of ITMO producer Francis.
The whole point was that morale had to be kept up, and they put this stream of programmes out. They took over every church hall, every school. They just put on these programmes. I mean, I used to sit in the corner of the studio, and my mother, who was a performer as well as a writer and a musician, quite often was writing the end of a programme, which at the other end of the studio was going out at the beginning live, remember? And everything she wrote had to be passed by the censor, and that went on to the actors and the musicians who read it dry. It was amazing, and I don't think anyone noticed. They just kept going somehow, but of course gradually it set down into a routine and a pattern. But of course the Germans found out and started bombing Bristol.
It was a hazardous time for variety staff. The Bristol Blitz began on a Sunday evening in late November 1940. The singer Betty Estelle continued to broadcast throughout the German raids of 1940 and early 1941.
It was a time when I don't know how they managed to schedule things, because so often the studios were destroyed and one would work by candlelight. But the fact remains that the powers that be managed to keep some sort of a schedule running the entire time. People were just terribly annoyed at the fact that they'd had the impertinence to drop bombs on Bristol, not that they were frightened.
At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia. This was no surprise to me.
When the Nazis broke their pact with Stalin and invaded Russia in June, that was the last straw. The BBC announced that Variety was bound for the sleepy university town of Bangor in North Wales. No one seemed to recall the words of Lord Haw-Haw broadcasting from Germany the previous October. "You may think you're safe in North Wales," he warned, "but your turn is coming." The God-fearing people of Bangor, after some initial consternation at the sudden arrival of what most regarded as a bohemian rabble, took to them. John Ammons was 17 and working in the special effects department. He recalls how Bangor's citizens reacted to the sudden influx of BBC types.
Well, they were astonished, I think. Consternation would be probably the most appropriate word, with all these peculiarly dressed people walking down Bangor High Street. But, of course, they did have the benefit of getting free tickets for shows. And I think there was quite a black market in tickets for shows. Things were exchanged, like bottles of whiskey, to get tickets for Etmar and other shows that we did there.
We used to think they were very wild, because we were rather puritanical in those days.
Jean Ware was a secretary in Variety during the Bangor era.
Of course, they went a lot to the pubs. They were Londoners, after all. I mean, most of them. They were from England, and they had different habits. And I don't think they all went to church on Sunday. In fact, I'm sure they didn't. They were all very cheerful and jolly, and we thought they were all quite old.
The symphony orchestra, two variety orchestras, jazz bands, actors and everything turned up, and they'd got nowhere to put them. They'd got this little tiny Welsh regional place at Bron Castell, and virtually nowhere else. So they had to take over places like the Penryn Hall and the local cinema theatre, all this to improvise studios, because it was supposed to be out of the range of enemy aircraft.
The BBC had chosen Bangor because they thought it safer than Bristol. But in the event, it was the only place in which Itmar was bombed off the air. It happened during a live transmission in 1943.
We smile at the judge and lift the prize. Tain't what you do. Oh, it isn't what you do. It's the way that you do it. Da, 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 da,
da, da, da. Some German pilot was lost on the way back from Belfast or something and dumped these bombs. But it was halfway through the transmission, and I remember clearly that when it happened, because this group, the twosome called the Bachelor Girls, singing a number called Taint What You Do, It's the Way That You Do It. And halfway through this, we heard this crunching noise. And dust and hymn books and all sorts of old hymn books fell from the ceiling in this Welsh converted chapel. And we stopped because it was faded out from London, because they didn't want the position to be given away of this studio when this bomb fell.
I'm sorry we had to leave Tommy Handley's show. It's that man again. You've just heard a recording of some Brahms waltzes played by the Orchestre Monde. And now here are some Hermann Finck melodies.
One can't help feeling now, although the official records say, oh, he was on his way to Liverpool. Well, you don't go to Liverpool that way anyway. I think now that it was a deliberate attempt, successful as it happened, to put Itmar off the air, because it was considered by the top brass in Germany. It made fun of Hitler. It had all these things, like Funf the spy, who although he was always there and always threatening all sorts of things, it was always ineffective. He never actually got anything spied. And Tommy Handley got put on the Nazi death list for singing a song called Who Is This Man Who Looks Like Charlie Chaplin? What makes him think he's going to win the war? And so on. Well, that kind of thing, the Germans couldn't bear this because basically they didn't have that kind of sense of humour and couldn't see the funny side of it. As it has to be said, neither could a lot of the BBC top brass.
While Itmar was having a year out, BBC Variety was busy on another front. It's one thing to make people laugh in wartime, but another to get them motivated to work hard, especially if they're worried about how the war's going. So the BBC's music policy was rewritten to permit unashamedly background music aimed at the mass audience. Sean Nicholas, author of The Echo of War, A History of the Wartime BBC.
I think Music While You Work was one of the most successful of all the BBC wartime programmes. In many respects, it was an absolute revolution in BBC programme output. One of the first memoranda to the production staff, in fact, said quite explicitly, "We are looking for a piece of bad programming," by which they meant they were looking for repetitive music, all roughly at the same tempo, the same kinds of music for half an hour to stretch with no commentary in between, for the reason, of course, that it fitted in with the rhythms of factory workers.
Johnny Roadhouse was an amateur musician working in a factory in Manchester when Music While You Work went on air.
They had a tannoy playing music for us, background music, to help us along with the war effort, you see, and cheer us all up. Well, there's a song came out during the war. It was called Deep in the Heart of Texas. It goes something like this. The stars at night are big and bright, bump, 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 deep in the heart of Texas.
Coyotes wail along the trail, deep in the heart of Texas.
Oh, Texas.
The rabbits rush round the brush.
Well, can you imagine 30,000 people all doing work in a factory, and whatever they had in their hands, whether it be a spanner, a cup of tea, or anything else, as soon as this song came on the tannoy, da-da-dee-ba-da-da-da, bash-bash-bash-bash, they don't concern about whether it's damaged or not. And there was so much damage going on amongst this components and the row that they had to have the song banned, and BBC banned the song for about 6 months, I think.
Workers' playtime dates from May 1941, 9 months into the Blitz, when the tide of war was still refusing to turn in Britain's favour. John Watt, the BBC's hard-pressed director of variety, was casting around for a show to echo the success of Garrison Theatre, a live relay from camp concerts staged in France for the British Expeditionary Force. Watt had the idea of putting on a similar show, but broadcast from a different factory each week. When the Minister of Labour, Ernest Bevin, gave the idea his active personal support, workers' playtime was the result. Joe Wrigley was a war worker at the Saunders Row aircraft factory in North Wales.
People's morale was very low. Hard work, long days, 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts, plus the bombings, awake all night. So some right person came up with the idea of using these artists and stars to boost the morale of the people mainly, which in turn would help the production of the war effort. These people were got out and they were taken on to factories all over the country, and they appreciated it.
By early 1942, nearly halfway through the war, Itmar was an unmissable weekly radio event, pulling a regular audience of 16 million people and causing life in Britain to stop for half an hour every Thursday night. The wireless was now the chief source of entertainment in a nation imprisoned at night by German air raids, and it was said that if Hitler invaded between 8:30 and 9 on a Thursday, there'd be no opposition because everybody would be listening to Itmar. By the time Itmar and the Variety Department returned to London in the summer of 43, the tide of war had turned. And yet it was in the dark dog days of war, when victory seemed very far from assured, that this extraordinary radio show achieved what John Watt called its enormous vogue and prestige. Why? The director, Jonathan Miller, believes that the programme offered the beleaguered British a mirror, a self-image that they rather admired.
It gave
the nation a tremendous sense of solidarity, and it meant that we thought that we were lovable as a nation. It made us feel that we were, in contrast to these sinister, ghastly herring folk, as Churchill called them, that we were these lovable English who all spoke in these memorable, silly catchphrases, and we were able to joke our way through the war.
It's that man again, it's that man again, it's a Tommy Handley in here.
When I think of it, Ma, I think, of course, of the signature tune, and that signature tune brings back a whole series of sort of Proustian memories. I mean, it's the acoustic equivalent for me of the Madeleine dipped in tea. It brings back a cluster of memories. And then, of course, there is the sound, the crackle of Handley's voice.
Ain't the boss back yet?
Not as I know. I'll let this is him.
Gee, it is the boss on a bulldozer.
Hello, Sam.
Say, boss.
Yeah?
What are you doing in that thing?
Well, I waved a red hanky for a taxi, and up came a bulldozer.
Well, what's that big scoop on the front for, boss?
Ah, that's a Judy catcher, Sam. I use it for picking up girls.
Can I do you now, sir?
All the people like Mrs. Mopp and Sam Verfecken. I mean, these were all people that we knew, and they spoke lines that we had heard people say. They are, of course, stereotypes, but they're also stereotypes that everyone had known. Everyone had met a gin-shaken figure in the pub who would mishear something and say, "A gin and tonic, sir. I don't mind if I do."
Look, Sam, if I'm going to stand for Parliament, I must have a double.
A double, Handley.
Oh, yes.
I don't mind if I do.
Say, you're early this morning, Colonel. Are you living here?
Yes, sir. I have a nice large room.
Large room, good idea. Pour it over my porridge.
Porridge, sir? Do you know what I have the first thing in the morning?
Yes, a hangover.
This is the BBC Home Service. We're interrupting programs to make the following announcement.
Yesterday morning, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air force.
With victory in Europe came a BBC purge and a settling of wartime scores. The chief victim was John Watt, who, Itmar notwithstanding, was blamed for too many flops and was forced to resign. The Director-General himself, William Hayley, delivered the coup de grace, accusing Watt of poor judgment in proposing that with the coming of peace, Itmar should be scrapped. In fact, the show soldiered on for nearly 4 more years until the sudden death of Tommy Handley in 1949, at the age of only 56.
We are holding our service this morning in memory of one whose achievement it was to bring week by week to millions of our people an overflowing measure of irresistible laughter.
While thousands lined Tommy Handley's funeral route, 6 deep for 6 miles, Wreath, resolutely grim to the end, could only say of Tommy Handley that such acclamation in death for a mere radio comedian was a sociological comment on the age. Dreadful, he complained, dreadful. Itmar, of course, was interred with Handley. Ted Kavanagh, who produced a golden cascade of Itmar scripts single-handedly for nearly 10 years, died bitter and before his time in 1958. His son still wonders why he was, to all intents and purposes, abandoned by the BBC.
I think it has to be remembered, God knows England still is class-led, but how deeply class-led it was at that time. And something like red-nosed comedians, as they would say, and Fred Ward variety, were for the people. You know, that's what they wanted. Really, I suppose we have to give it to them. Now, of course, they're idolized to a ridiculous extent, but in those days, were taken seriously or regarded as worthy of any sort of public recognition, whatever they'd done.
They really were the program which, with Churchill, if words can win battles, they won battles. I suppose one forgets very quickly, and once we'd won the war and went into that horrible, dull period when sweet rationing came back again and all that sort of long-drawn misery, I suppose we were so tired that nobody made a fuss that he wasn't Sir Tommy Hanley by then. He should have been knighted, and or Ted Kavanagh should have had something, and Francis Worsley deserved something. They all deserved something.
The great thing about the war, awful though it was that that point, and at no time since, please note, we were all pulling in the same direction. Therefore, when you tuned in, it was the great thing you did. You turned on the radio at 8:30 that evening when Itmar went out, and you knew on the bus next morning, in the tube, in the shelter, wherever you were at the workplace, what happened on Itmar last night was the great talking point. It pulled us all together.
Next week, the Yanks are coming.
And now, gang, before we go on with the program, I feel I should read a cable which we've just received from Hollywood. It says, Vic Oliver, Phoebe Daniels, Ben Lyon, London. Best wishes to you all and all members of the High Gang program for your continued success. Please convey my deepest feelings to all the brave people of Britain and all my British friends. We think of them all the time. Signed, Bing Crosby.
Britain may have her back to the wall, but at least her seams are straight, with nylon supplied by those terribly nice guys from over there. And that's not all they brought over here. Next week, we'll look at the impact America had on radio humour.
When trouble's brewing, it is doing that man, and that again.
Biggs the Cheerful was presented by Bill Tidy. The series was written by Roger Wilkes and produced in Manchester by Libby Cross.